And welcome back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rick Tocchini. Our very special guest today is Ed Rego, former P&G executive. Today we're talking about core values, leadership insights, and becoming the best version of yourself. Welcome, Ed, and please provide your background.
I joined P&G in June the 7th of 1965, well before any of you were born. My initial area was food product development in the R&D area, and my last position was vice president of food and beverage products was the title, but it was in the commercial products group. And I had, you know, any number of twists and turns between those two endpoints. I went out as an executive on loan in 1996. And at that same time, the company named me vice president of government relations in North America, which I think was a title just to suit the executive on loan situation I was in. I served that in that role for 6 years as I developed and created the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. And I retired in July of 2001.
And tell us where you served.
First, at the Winton Hill Technical Center for 22 years, and then at the general offices downtown Cincinnati for the remainder.
Where are you from originally?
New Orleans. I was a chemistry major from Xavier University of Louisiana, which is located in New Orleans, and got my master's degree in biochemistry from the University of Cincinnati.
Now let's talk about core values in the 1960s through the 1990s.
My background is complex because I was, to my knowledge, the first African-American management level person in food product development. And I was coming from a city that really had no opportunities to speak of for professionals, college trained people who were African-American. And then I was dealing with, you know, a segregated South, but a difficult North. and Proctor was new at it also. So there was some complexity there. My background was I grew up poor, although like a lot of poor people say, I didn't really know how poor I was. My value was twofold. I was looking for security for my then new family. My wife and I were married on June 5th, 1965, and we left our wedding reception to go to the job at Procter & Gamble. So we had that Saturday night and Sunday for our honeymoon in Cincinnati before I went to work. So I was attracted to P&G because of the quality image that it had just based on its brands. When I saw the list of brands that the company had, I thought, I've got to go there. This is a place that believes in quality. And my number one need was security. Mm-hmm. Even though personally, I thought of myself as a creative person because I had a lot of different interests, science, mathematics, art, and music. I was an artist and a musician all through school. I just felt that P&G was the right place for me. And I thought research and development, or product development, as I came to learn, was the place. But then when I interviewed, they took me in the labs, in the analytical chemistry labs, and did a half day of interviews there before realizing that wasn't what I was interested in. A guy said, you know, maybe you're a products researcher. And I said, what's that? And he started talking about how, you know, they understood consumer needs and turned those into product concepts and ultimately products in the marketplace, branded products in the marketplace that, you know, had your personal creativity in them. And I said, you just hit it perfectly. That's what I want to do. I'd never heard of this, but that's what I want to do. So over the years, I learned about vision and team building and innovation. Innovation is a huge one for me, innovative thinking. And I learned about leadership and collaboration. And so all those things fit my personality and my value system very well.
So coming from the South, how did you develop your own core values?
I have to say that my value system wasn't well developed. It was good. It had some of the right principles, many of which I learned even starting in at home, of course, but in high school. We had a very disciplined high school run by a priest, Josephite priest. It was all black high school, but it was very high academic. Still is today one of the best academic institutions, as well as one of the best athletic. And so these were priests who pushed you as far as you could possibly go. They didn't spare the paddle, and they had tracks, you know. Class was set up on tracks A through D, I think, was the bottom. And I just strove to be the number one in the school. I came out the number three in the school, and won just about all the awards for all the academic prizes. So I already had that kind of drive. And then when I saw the quality of people at P&G, I thought, wow, they're all that way. I'm not so special. And, you know, just a 100% strong, smart folk. And that was most impressive.
Can you describe your first encounter with a mentor?
Yeah, sure. It was called not just day one. It was called the night I arrived, which it was about 8 o'clock. And Paul Bates, who was to be my section head, picked Carol and I up from the airport.
Okay.
And while we were on the plane, the attendants had given us two small bottles of champagne, having recognized that since our whole wedding party put us on the plane, that it was our wedding anniversary. And And so Paul drove us around Cincinnati. He said, Ed, I know you didn't get a chance to see Cincinnati when you were here. Carol's never been here. Let me take you around. So he drives us around for a couple of hours. And this is my honeymoon night, right? And we got to the hotel, and my wife said, Paul, why don't you come in and have some champagne with us? He said, I think I will. So he came in and chatted. Paul Bates became my mentor, my best friend, and best friend of the family, his family. He was remarkable. He tailor-made a training program for me that was written in a big booklet that I followed just religiously. Every step, every experiment he written up for me to do, and every product test he asked me to do, and I reported on those religiously. And so I saw that same discipline that I valued so much in my high school. Yet he was a really gentle man who just coached me and coaxed me along until I got over my naivete. He was excellent. And then I had two more, at least two more, probably three more people like that in my career, spaced out, typically at the right time. You know, I remember when I moved from foods, from the foods division to the then toilet goods division, it was Ken Erickson who was the director of toilet goods. Product development, who asked for me. And he had been trying to get me into his organization for over a year. And he was fighting with another director, the director of food product development, who was Bill Ames. And Bill left and went to Pillsbury. That was one of the first times any high-level manager, at least during my time, had, you know, jumped ship. But Ken Erickson revealed to me later that Phil Ames was holding me back. He said, you should have been promoted. You should have been making more money. But he, for whatever reason, was, you know, holding you back. And that's why I reached out for you. And it finally took me going to our mutual boss to say, you know, you either promote this guy in your shop or you give him to me. And that's how I got moved over to Toilet Goods and had three promotions in a very short period of time.
When Paul picked you up at the airport, the mentoring started, huh? And how do you project yourself like Paul Bates?
I think the most significant one was when I was appointed director of product development in what was called the food service and lodging products division. The organization was not very trusting or welcoming. I don't know what the context was for them before I arrived, but for whatever reason, they were very, very withdrawn and cautious. And I pulled them all together. What I did was do one-on-one interviews with everyone in the organization. I scheduled those over several weeks and completed them all, and then had a picnic. Business meeting picnic combination, where I introduced the notion of HOF, HOFF, which was a way to express my values and principles. And it stands for honesty, openness, fairness, and fun. And actually, the last F was fulfillment, but I said it as fun, make it simple.
Sure.
And then I talked to them about these principles and how I really believe in them. And over time, they really did take on to this. In fact, I run into some of those folks out of that organization periodically who they always bring up Hoff and how they took on Hoff as a way to describe their values. And in subsequent outings we had, they created T-shirts. There was one that had a dragon on it, and it was called Hoff the Magic Dragon. really relates to another area that I think was breakthrough, and it came for me personally, and it came with training, formal training. We did the visioning thing, and I can't remember the agency that did that, but I'm sure you've run across that. We did Ned Herman's whole brain, you know, the Herman Brain Profile,
mm-hmm.
Center for Creative Studies or whatever he called it in North Carolina. I spent a week there and took that back and just absorbed it and put it into my daily life, and I still use it today in my company. In terms of how my brain operates, it's much more intellectual than it is limbic, social, emotional, but I've learned to develop some of my social, emotional skills as well. But analysis and synthesis, those two are what I live on, and you know, I love creativity, I love building, I love innovation. So the analysis part that I learned so well at P&G, I probably would not have learned that because I lean much more towards synthesis. But I know how to do analysis, and I got disciplined into doing it. And, you know, the one pagers make you do it. Every aspect of P&G makes you very strong analytically. And it's because of my appreciation for the innovation process, which I personally understood and mapped even before Procter did its product launch model, but it's very similar. It's four phases. And I use that in my work. For example, in Toilet Goods, we put together a packaging team, a product delivery team, we actually called it. It was more than packaging. It was functional packaging and product interactions. And I purposely put in it diverse thinkers. So we got people who were analytical, people who were strong in synthesis. We put some people in who related to people so they could draw out consumer needs. And we mixed it up with, you know, different approaches, different thought styles. And that little team generated, you know, 20 or 30 major packaging innovations in a few months. And a lot of those didn't get developed till much, much later. But, they were doing things that were not on the marketplace. And I knew then that this works. I mean, this whole innovation, this was the conceptualization phase of innovation. So phase one's conceptualization, then there's modeling, and then there's feasibility, and then there's launch or implementation. And each of those phases has to be managed differently. The only key decisions for the management have to do with moving from one phase to the next. That's the only key decision. Very important decision, but the only key decision. And it's also very sequential. You can attempt to overlap it, but chances are you'll screw it up. And that's where a lot of failures happen. And I learned from failures, too. That's the other thing. P&G lets you fail.
Can you give me specific examples?
Well, I worked on Pringles. I was what they called the technical brand manager. And that was because we were jealous of marketing brand managers. And we said, we're every bit as important as those guys, although the company may not recognize it. So we called ourselves technical brand managers, and I was the technical brand manager on Pringles from early development all the way through national launch. And did I learn a lot of stuff. We had, his name just escaped me. We had a national pollster who did the consumer research, the initial consumer research on needs in the potato chip area. Yankelovich, Daniel Yankelovich.
Okay.
And Dan, I reconnected with Dan in my later life when I was doing the Freedom Center, and I got him to do some incredible work for us on the needs and for the Freedom Center audience. That's a whole nother story. But what Dan did in Pringles is he did one-on-one in-depth interviews, a lot of them, for several hours each, and dug into every aspect of need and psychology and in this potato chip world and related worlds. And out of that, the interpretation of those findings, we created Pringles. Major thing. Now, executionally, there were a lot of things that happened that were tough and, had us going backwards sometimes, but we got it all the way through. Obviously, a big success. Secret Insurer antiperspirants. I helped with Leo Burnett and Bob Whaling to create Strong Enough for a Man, Made for a Woman. At a session in Lake Geneva Playboy Club late one night as we went around the room talking about, what secret is and what it isn't. And that line came out of that directly out of that session. I had some, as I said, failures like Cold Snap. I did a little bit of work on Alestra, I wasn't key to that project. But I was the associate director in charge of Duncan Hines' soft cookies. And if you know that story, that's an incredible story. That was a success that became a market failure, even though it was a legal success with the largest settlement on a patent infringement in history at that time. I think it was like $120 million, of course, that's peanuts today. But we applied every aspect of the innovation model to the Duncan Hines cookies, and we did everything right except underestimate the ruthlessness of our competition. And Nabisco literally stole the product from us I mean, they sent people into our plant in Chicago and stole dough and stole formulas.
So orbiting above all of that, was there a forgiveness factor for failure?
Yes, I think so. The failure was never one person's, and that's part of the collaborative team approach that we have. At least in my experience, there's never been a situation where, you know, one person screwed it up, and that's why it's a... I suppose you could say that there were some leaders who were leading things down blind alleys. Cold Snap was an example of that. And that's one where I was too young and naive to push back on Chuck Jarvie, who was probably the strongest-minded manager I ever met. And he was enamored with the project. There were two or three guys who were leading the development effort before I got on it who he kicked out because they didn't do what he wanted them to do, so he got rid of them. And then I got on it, and I saw the flaws, but I tried to fix them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not fixable because the concept was flawed.
Tell us about Cold Snap.
Great tasting frozen dessert that you make at home. Kind of like ice cream with a lot of frills on it, but you whip it up at home and put it in your freezer. Well, the problem was the product models were great. The product models were made from real ice cream and real fresh ingredients. The product execution, prototypes and feasible products were made from this chemical sludge, slurry that took forever to freeze and tasted like a chemistry set.
Chemical sludge, the mere words used here are priceless. You sound like a chemist.
Every one of these had product models that were excellent and tested well. Every one of the ones that I worked on. It's when you get to prototypes, feasible products, and scale-ups. The Pringles scale-up was flawed. The plant was not producing target quality product, and we had to scrap tons. So the cost of that startup, and I remember people gnashing their teeth over it, again, a case where there was a minor failure, actually significant failure at the time, but minor in the long scheme of things. There was weeping and gnashing over what to do, and, you know, should we scrap it or not, or should we just try to push it through? And, you know, that's the other thing. Procter always tends to make the right decision, even if there's some gnashing of teeth, and do the right thing. It's, you know, like Brad Butler with the feminine hygiene product that, you know, caused... They never even proved it. Yeah, rely on the toxic shock syndrome.
Yeah, right.
I guess it was never really proven that rely caused toxic shock, but Brad and whomever else got involved in that decision scrapped a winning product. So there was no question.
It sounds like you practice core values every day.
Yeah, and it's the core values of my company today. I actually own a $600 million company. which is not too far from where Procter was when I joined them. They were a couple of billion. And it has as its values the acronym RIDE, which is responsiveness, integrity, diversity, and excellence. And those come right out of my P&G training.
So let's talk about RIDE, responsive, integrity, diversity, and excellence. You had the chance to set the values at a new company, and you basically adopted P&G core values.
And it's diversity of thought as well. And, you know, it's the example I gave you of the packaging product delivery system group. There wasn't a whole lot of racial or ethnic diversity in that group, mm-hmm. but there was a heck of a lot of diversity of thought style and thinking.
So tell us about this company.
Well, today it's pretty mundane, but it's going to grow into something a lot less mundane here pretty quickly. But we produce tire and wheel assemblies for major automobile manufacturers. We are actually the largest tire and wheel assembler in the country. And so what we do is, and this is all about discipline, what we do is purchase tires and wheels, put them together in the configuration that the OEM dictates, and we produce them in sequence and deliver them just in time, you know, properly inflated with tire pressure monitors, with uniformity tests being completed, high quality, so they hit the road and give the ultimate consumer the best ride. So it parallels our value acronym in terms of what we're about. We're consumer, we're customer intimate, so we know what the customer wants and we deliver it. And that's all Procter. It's all Procter Manufacturing and Engineering, too. I am dabbling in a couple of other areas that will grow this company significantly. One is the nanotechnology area, because I'm a big technology nut, and I found some very strong science and technology in a small company that I'm working with to introduce that into the automotive sector, but also into the consumer products sector, because I can't get away from consumer products. And we're also building a plant in a depressed neighborhood so we can hire folks in that neighborhood and make jobs. So people can, this comes from my Freedom Center background of trying to give people the wherewithal to reach higher and higher levels of freedom. The one thing that I'm most proud of in my post-Procter life is coming up with a model for what freedom is. And it's, again, based on Maslow's hierarchy of need, where it's a, you know, the typical triangle. Down at the bottom are all the nasty things that we're trying to eradicate, like pain and suffering and discrimination and all that. And I call that freedom from. And in the middle section, which I call freedom of, are the, you know, rights, freedom of speech and freedom of religion and so forth. And then at the top are freedom to, and it's the things we're aspiring to pursuing, and those are empowerment and actualization. So thing, and this is my the rest of my life I'm devoting to, how do you take people from where they are, either literally where they are or where they perceive themselves to be, and move them to higher and higher levels of freedom, giving them the wherewithal to do that, giving them the inspiration and the challenge to do that, and the tools to do that. And so having a successful consumer business or manufacturing business and giving folks a chance to work and become ultimately become empowered to give inclusion, to help some entrepreneurs grow, that's my world today.
Tell us, at what point in your career did you turn from a thought leader to a legacy thinker?
Boy, that's a really good question. My friend Bob Whaling, when I was an executive on loan, I reported to him. And I saw him at the airport the other day on his way to get his Lifetime Advertising Award, New York. Okay. And I always thank him, because I was supposed to be an executive on loan for 2 years. And I would meet with Bob for breakfast periodically and update him on how things were going at the for the development of the Freedom Center. And, you know, I told him up front that this is not a 2-year deal, that the average for a new museum of this magnitude is 9 years. It takes 9 years to do it. But he would come and meet with me, and I would ask for an extension, and he'd give it to me. And, you know, he was so pleased with the work. I would get kind of normal raises and bonuses and stock options. I mean, it was like the best of all worlds. And then I was contributing my salary back to the Freedom Center. Then I had talked John Pepper into being my campaign manager, and he and I would go all over the country and we raised, I had raised $16 million before I asked John to come on, and together we raised over $100 million. But Bob, after two extensions in going into my sixth year, he said, "Ed, this is it. We can't have this be any longer." He said, "You either got to come back or you got to retire." And I said, "I don't want to come back. I've tasted what this is about and what I can do on my own now that I." You know, one of the things P&G, it's so disciplined that you don't have a whole lot of room for to exercise your creativity. That's something that needs to be worked on, and AG has worked on that, and I'm sure Bob will. That's when I started thinking, you know, I've got to build some wealth. John Pepper was given personally millions of dollars to the Freedom Center. And I gave probably $500,000 just by not taking my salary. And I said, "John, I want to do a lot more for the Freedom Center. But you know what? I just gave 9 years of my life that could have been building wealth for my family. And it could have been creating a legacy. And so that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to go to work for somebody. I'm going to go build wealth."
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I could do it. That my confidence had been built over those years to the point where there wasn't anything I didn't think I could do or accomplish. And I think the breakthrough with the Freedom Pyramid helped me to decide where I wanted to put that effort and that energy. And it's driving me.
Can we actually accelerate legacy thinking?
That's very similar to what we've tried to do at the Freedom Center, and they've now got an ad campaign that's beginning to touch on it. It says, take a spark and light the flame, or something along those lines. So we're trying to take that spark that's inside of most folks and turn it into a flame and show them how to do, inspire them to, and challenge them to do that. So you will take courageous steps for freedom today.
Well, thanks, Ed, for being on.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Do you want to mention anything about Mike Milligan?
I can't let you go away without mentioning his name because when I made the transition from R&D to marketing and general management, that was not a transition that you could do at Procter. It was very rare. And it was Mike Milligan who said, Ed, you can do anything you want in this company and I'll see to it. And he did it. He's kind of a military guy. He's a Williams College guy, just a general, you know, I mean, a military general, that kind of guy. He was a sales VP. And he also is a guy who, when I lost my spleen in an automobile accident, sat in the hospital for 11 straight days. He'd come from work and hold my wife's hand through two surgeries, you know, while I was dying in 1983. I mean, and that's the Proctor I knew. Yeah. So I really appreciate you guys taking this on. It's a big, big task. I don't know how you do it, but I'm happy to participate.
So that's how Ed Regal sees it. We really appreciate you, Ed.
All right. Take care.
Thanks again, folks, for joining us on Success Made to Last. And always remember, be the best version of you. Have a great week. So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasine@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program.